that Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, and they just disagree on how.
We're gonna get across that wasteland, and we're gonna do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
The only daily Premier League podcast. This is Football Social Daily.
Welcome to your Monday edition of Football Social Daily. I'm Jim Salverson, that's Niall McCorn.
Hello.
That's Marley Anderson.
Good morning.
And we're going to be looking back over the weekend's action, not by a game-by-game, blow-by-blow analysis. We left that to Fergal and the boys yesterday on the podcast, which you can go and find on the feed now. Today we're going to be looking at who deserves a bit of glory and who deserves to be put into detention. We're going to be judging our heroes and villains from the weekend's action very shortly. We've also got the small matter of the biggest derby in English football to go at. It's Palace versus Brighton. It's the Battle of the M23. We'll be giving our views on that very shortly. And I want to start off with something that may be slightly controversial on today's Football Social Daily, because it feels a little bit early to be talking about who's going to get the sack, who's going to lose their job. But we're going to do it anyway, because what are we? 6 games into the Premier League season now, and there's some people that may find themselves in different parts of the table than they expected at the beginning of the season.
Not me.
Steve Bruce in Newcastle is as expected. But there's maybe a couple of other shocks in that table. I want to talk about who is going to be feeling the pressure at the moment, going through some of the managers that I think the board could be starting to question, certainly over the next couple of weeks. And because of the result at the weekend, the thrashing by Arsenal for Tottenham, I think Nuno Espirito Santo is maybe finding his position at Tottenham under pressure. Now, this comes off the back of a very poor result at the weekend and a very poor display as well. Is it going that badly for Nuno at Spurs, or is it pure reaction to losing the North London derby to Arsenal?
Both. It is going badly for Nuno at Spurs, and they were humbled by Arsenal, and in the first 35 minutes, humiliated. They were 3-0 down after 34 minutes in a North London derby. And all of the talk is around Harry Kane and how it looks like he doesn't want to be there, but there's still 10 other players on the pitch. And Nuno Espirito Santo, it's his job to try and squeeze as much juice out of those players as he possibly can. Now, there's also the question marks over him as a manager in the first place, in terms of him not being Tottenham's first choice when Jose Mourinho was sacked. Obviously, Ryan Mason was in temporary charge. And this summer, there was a hunt for a manager. And it was a pretty public hunt, to be fair, from Tottenham Hotspur. And Nuno Espirito Santo wasn't really anywhere near the top of that shortlist.
No.
But yet he finds himself in the job. So you have to have a little bit of sympathy for him in that respect, because The managers that Tottenham chased didn't want to come to the club. Now, that sends a message to me about Tottenham Hotspur as a football club and the way things are run operationally behind the scenes. And, you know, Nuno Espirito Santo left Wolves, kind of a mutual consent thing where they both knew that it was getting a bit stale at Wolves. It's already gone stale at Tottenham for Santo. You know, they started brilliantly in the international break, or the recent international break, I think the end of the month, August. They were top of the table, having won 3 games, all 3 of them 1-0. Arsenal, bottom of the table, they had lost all three and I think they had a -9 goal difference.
Yeah.
20 places between the two sides. And everyone was saying, well, maybe Spurs do have a little bit here. But since then, they've been beaten by Chelsea, they were demolished by Crystal Palace, and they've been demolished again by Arsenal.
Did that win over City, that very first day win, where everyone expected City to absolutely walk that, didn't that paper over some cracks at the time that maybe weren't apparent?
Massively. And I think that you always get those strange results on the first day of a season. It's just one of those things where no one really knows what the deal is at the start of the season with every team. I mean, the chances of Manchester City losing on opening day aren't particularly great, but Spurs aren't a bad side. They've got good players. Mm. It's just one of those things where I absolutely agree the cracks were very much papered over. And are they cracks that, you know, Nuno Espirito Santo is the builder to fix?
Mm.
You know, has he got the tools and the skills to fix those problems for Tottenham? So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that with what Spurs expect and with how they want to become a European heavyweight, really, in the future with the stadium they've got, then they've got a big problem. And I feel for Nuno Espirito Santo because, you know, it's not like he's trying for things to go wrong. Mm. His managers always want to be successful. But I think if they do pull the trigger and send him on his way, Tottenham risk becoming exactly what they've lambasted Chelsea fans for the last 15 years. Oh, you hire and fire, you sack your managers, you might win silverware, but you've got no legacy. Well, it works for Chelsea.
And Tottenham are going to do it without the silverware part.
Tottenham are going to do it without the silverware part if they carry on. But it's certainly looking grim for Santo. I think I saw a statistics graphic on Sky Sports at the weekend where I think that they're 17th for shots, or they're basically, they rank very, very low in terms of the statistics side of things. And I know the game isn't played off of data and analysis. You know, the good old-fashioned two eyes test works quite well. And from what I saw against Arsenal, it looks like a Spurs side devoid of life, devoid of energy, and devoid of ideas from a manager who might well be out of his depth.
Bottom of the stats chart in terms of average distance run in a game as well, which I think is never a particularly good sign for a team. It often smacks of a team not necessarily trying for their manager. I guess, Marley, the kind of reasons that we're questioning him coming into the job and being that fifth, sixth choice or whatever he was could actually be what keeps him in the job. Because Spurs, if they do get rid of Nuno Espirito Santo, who do they go to? Do they go to their seventh choice, their eighth choice?
Well, I think, was it like something like 92 days it took them from having no manager to eventually appointing Nuno? So, you know, if that's happened when you've got time to do things, you know, in the summer, basically, you don't want to repeat that process when you don't have time. Because in the meantime, while you're trying to find someone new, you're losing games or you're continuing with a manager you're unhappy with. So I can't see him being sacked. There's also the money thing when it comes back to Levy, and he doesn't like spending money. He won't want to pay out compensation, you know, 5 weeks or whatever it is, 6 weeks into the season. Is he on a two or three year contract? So, you know, it's still a fair whack of cash. So, the logic suggests he's gonna stay. I don't think he'll get sacked anytime soon. I think two or three managers will probably go before him. But he's not. I don't know why it's changed, because it was going well, and then they beat Man City, and then the next game they lost to Crystal Palace. So it was almost like,
Where's
that come from? And Palace haven't looked any good since, have they? Mm. Like, you know, Palace aren't a good team. I'll say that. Crystal Palace fans probably hate me to death, but they're just not a very good team. And they've smashed Spurs, and then Spurs just, I feel like they feel sorry for themselves all the time, and it takes them ages to get over something like a setback. And once they reach the top of anything, they have a good result, they believe their own hype, and then they get beat, and then they just lick the wounds for the next 5 weeks and end up losing three of them games and drawing the other in, putting pressure on the manager again. So,
how much of this is about Harry Kane? Because you mentioned him, Niall, the fact that he isn't on form, but he's never on form in kind of August, September, is it? It takes him ages to find the net normally. And the narrative is obviously going to be that he didn't want to be at Spurs. He wanted to leave for another club. And if you have a firing Harry Kane in your team,
yeah,
that adds 10% to you.
Yeah,
no question.
Chance.
But you can't, at the same time, you can't blame him in its entirety for Spurs not performing.
And you can even use Manchester United's performance this weekend against Aston Villa as an example. You know, Ronaldo, Fernandes, Pogba, Greenwood. You know, all of these players who Manchester United have, and they were poor against Aston Villa. I mean, they had, I think, 20-odd shots and only three of them were on target. You know, you can have all of the attacking players in the world. If you can't get it going, then you can't expect to win games. And, you know, Harry Kane, we've spoken about him. And actually, one thing I will give Santo credit for is the way he dealt with the Kane situation in the summer. I thought he dealt with it very, very well, particularly with the media and with the questions that were being thrown his way when he was new in the job. He just said, listen, I'm here to do a job and Harry Kane is our player until I'm told otherwise. Yeah. And I think he dealt with it expertly. Unfortunately for Kane, he's come back and it's just, it feels flat. It feels limp, feels devoid of all real life and enthusiasm and excitement. And that isn't what Tottenham should be. You know, with a stadium that's not really even 2-3 years old, one of the best in the world, a new manager, the best player staying, Son signing a new 6-year contract, fresh faces coming into the side. This should be an exciting time for Tottenham Hotspur, and it feels the total opposite. But you're right, you can't hang your hat on Harry Kane every single week. Now, the last 3 or 4 seasons, he's consistently performed every single week and scored goals more often than not in every game. But you can't expect him to continue that. And, you know, Tottenham to be successful in spite of him doing that should be a given. You know, when your best player doesn't play well, you should be able to find enough when you're a team of Tottenham's stature and quality to find a way through to win the game. They haven't done that. So I think it's an easy avenue, isn't it, to blame the lack of Harry Kane's form on Tottenham's recent performances. But it runs much deeper than that for me.
You mentioned there's some other managers that you think might go before Nuno Espirito Santo, Marley. I mean, some of the managers that are probably sweating a little bit at the moment include Mikel Arteta at Arsenal, probably Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Manchester United. Even though they're in fourth still at the moment, there was some calls about his team's performance at the weekend, and there's always pressure on him as a manager. Sean Dyche, Daniel Farker, although they've probably got teams that you'd expect to be at the wrong end of the table, they certainly are failing to pick up points so far this season. Who do you think the pressure is on from those managers? Who do you think will be the first to get their P45?
I think it deserves to be Farker, if I'm honest. I think I'm usually in favour of managers who've brought a team up from the Championship getting, you know, time to sort it out, but it's different with Norwich because he's brought them up before and he's done, you know, they started off well and then ultimately went down with a whimper. And I feel like if you sit and let that happen again, that is terrible management of you know, director level sort of management of a football club, because, you know, in my opinion, Norwich have gone backwards since coming into the Premier League because they sold Buendia. And yes, okay, Buendia was always going to leave the club, but I think there's a time to let him leave, and it's not just before a season starts in the summer before. They haven't signed well enough. The goals have dried up. Pukki's not the same as he was a couple of years ago when everyone quickly shoveled him into the fantasy team and got points off him left, right and centre when he came up in the Premier League last time. The new signings, Rashica, Lees, Malou, they're not good enough to... Brandon Williams at left back, he's learning. He's trying to, you know, swim in deep water very quickly. And I've... feel a bit sorry for him, but also, you know, he took that challenge on. He knew what he was getting into. And I think, yeah, Norwich is the one I would worry about. Losing 6 out of 6, no real signs of it improving until we play Newcastle.
I mean, I guess the thing that Daniel Farker has got this heritage with Norwich, and that protects him to a certain extent. Sean Dyche, should probably say, was the same at Burnley. And another manager I'd probably put into that category of has a lot of credit with the fans is Bielsa at Leeds, Niall, because you look at the start they've made to the season. I don't think they've got a win yet.
No.
They're in trouble. They look in trouble, but there is no one questioning his future because of how much credit he has with Leeds United and with the fans there.
I agree. And, you know, he's got a mural in Leeds and they love him for what he's done for the club, getting them back to the Premier League after 16 years and, you know, walking around Sainsbury's in his Leeds tracksuit top, cycling to work through down the cycle lane to the training ground. You know, they're all things that kind of make him a bit of a cult icon in Leeds. And Leeds have fallen on tough times. And They came close to promotion from the Championship a few years ago, and then Bielsa came in and really kind of revolutionised things. And, you know, they fell agonisingly short in his first season, and then in his second season they managed to get the job done. And he'll be forever loved at Leeds United for achieving that. Obviously, he's got this thing where he only signs one-year contracts, which is always a cause for concern because it literally gets to the last day of pre-season before it's announced that he signs this new one-year deal. I think with Bielsa, they've got someone who tactically knows what he's doing. I think they've also got a number of injuries at the back. I mean, obviously, Pascal Strike's been out with a suspension due to a red card. Diego Llorente's been injured. Robin Koch's been injured. I think they've had some issues at the back in terms of their defensive capabilities, just with players and personnel missing. So I think that they'll come good eventually.
When you have that, like from Bielsa's point of view, when you have issues at the back, when you're missing defenders, and they are undoubtedly, I think they're missing the first two choice centre-backs, and you need to tighten up, don't you? As a manager, surely, and this is the fundamental problem with Bielsa and his football, is that idealistically, he wants to play open attacking football.
Yes.
But when you've got no backbone to your team, when you've got no solidity at the back, you can't play that football. They faced 20 shots against my lot at the weekend, and West Ham aren't the most defensive of teams.
I know, but I mean, Bielsa's kind of old school in the sense that the point of football is to outscore the opposition, and he'll back his team to do that. You score five, we'll score six. You know, that's the kind of mentality that I think his sides have had throughout the years, and he's ultimately right. If you win, you get 3 points. And, you know, if you concede five but score six, your goal difference is a differential of one. So, you know, if it's going down to the fine margins of goals scored and goals conceded, then obviously that's unfortunate at the end of a season. But I definitely think that that's his mentality, and maybe he does need to change. And I think that's something, you know, you can level that at Daniel Farke as well. Maybe he needs to change, because the football that gets Norwich up from the Championship isn't good enough to keep them in the Premier League. You know, with Bielsa, though, in terms of we're talking about a sack race, he will walk away from Leeds United before he's sacked. I think that Bielsa's the sort of character where if he knows things have gone stale and they aren't going right and it's a black hole that he can't get out of and there's no fix to the problems that he has, let's just say in the next month they don't get a win and they're still in the relegation zone and they just don't look like the same side that they did before, I think he'll walk away. I think he will. I think he's the sort of character that will walk away for the greater good of the club.
I don't know if he'll walk away during a season, though. I think definitely at the end of the season, if they finish like 14th or something, he'll probably go.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure about in the middle, because then you do more damage then, because...
Yeah, I'm not sure he's bothered, though, is he?
Yeah.
This is a guy who signs one-year deals and leaves people on tenterhooks towards the end.
Yeah, but that's because he's his biggest self-critic. Yeah. He doesn't want to take the team backwards. And therefore,
would he not walk away if he's his own biggest critic?
Does he sign the deal, though, because he wants to honour the deal? It's like, does he only go 1 year because he knows he wants to be a man of his word and wants to see out his contract?
Regardless of what happens, if he leaves this season, if he stays on for another 10 years, I think Leeds need to start thinking about what happens after Bielsa. Because it feels like it's Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds United, and that he's bigger than some of the players they've got.
Yeah.
He's more important.
Well, he is.
He is. Well, he is. You know, he's the key component. And I think that that's always a danger, you know, of any manager kind of being bigger than the team and the sum of its parts. And I can't see him being sacked, put it that way. I can't see him walking away either. But I think that, you know, if things are still bad for Leeds in the next couple of months, it'd be really interesting to see what does happen.
Certainly, in terms of the odds, he's not going anywhere anytime soon. 25-1 to be the next manager sacked. You'll be pleased to know, Marley, Steve Bruce tops that list. 10-3 are his odds. And also Patrick Vieira is on that list. 14-1, his chances of being the first man out of Premier League employment. And we'll talk about Patrick Vieira's Crystal Palace, who are playing Brighton tonight, next on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. The magic of the M23 derby awaits us tonight, and that is the final game of the weekend's Premier League action. It is Palace versus Brighton. I've been impressed with Brighton so far this season, Marley. They've been a bit of a surprise package, and if they win tonight, they go top of the Premier League. What's been the difference between this season and last season?
Do you know what? Not much. Their general level of play is the same. They've always been dominant with the ball in terms of possession. they create chances. They just happen to be taking enough to win games so far this season. And fair play to them, because, you know, everybody talks about Brighton being, you know, not good enough, too good to finish like 15th, like they have done for the last, I think they finished 15th twice in a row, and then I think last year was either 16th or 14th, I can't remember. But yeah, they, you know, they've something's clicked. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it'll last, because they've still not got a new striker. They didn't go out and buy one in the summer. I thought they definitely needed to. But if Welbeck and Maupay, if one of them can score every week, then, you know, long may this little adventure continue, because they're a much better team than Crystal Palace. I think they proved that. I think the last time they played, like, Brighton had like 25 shots, 70% possession, and Crystal Palace had two shots in the entire game and won 2-1. So it's nice to see Brighton get the sort of results of their general level of play, because it is frustrating sometimes, like as a neutral, when you can see teams trying to play properly and doing well enough, but then not getting anything to show for it, because it almost makes you feel like, oh, should they play a bit more like Burnley and have two banks of four all the time and try and win, you know, flick-ons and play a different way? Because sometimes as a neutral, you want to see the teams that play the nice football get the results that they deserve. And Brighton do that as well, as well as most other teams, to be fair. So, yeah, they've made a good start, and they'll hopefully carry on against Crystal Palace, because, like, logic would suggest that they are the better team. And but, you know, reluctant to call it a derby, but derby's form goes out the window, as the old cliche goes.
I think they're keen, both Palace and Brighton fans, particularly Palace fans, to stress it isn't a derby, it's a rivalry. It's not the M23 derby, the A23 derby. They hate it. They really dislike it being called that. And I understand, actually, as a Pompey fan, when we were down in League 2 with Plymouth, Sky used to tee it up as the Dockyard Derby. Mm. You know, Portsmouth's closer to Birmingham than it is to Plymouth. So, I mean, there's no derby there.
Is that, and we both when got... When was this? When you were in what league?
League 2.
And they were down... well, that's because you were nowhere near Southampton.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well,
in terms of playing them every week.
But Sky are trying to force a derby. Yeah. Like, they called it the Dockyard Derby. No Plymouth or Portsmouth fan had ever called it the Dockyard Derby before, you know, the guys from broadcast jumped on the bandwagon and created a name for it. The fact we've both got shipbuilding dockyards, you know, is kind of manufactured derby. The fact that there's a road between Brighton and Croydon.
It's just to get people to watch Monday Night Football.
Exactly,
it
is. But, I mean, it's a game in which there's no love lost between the two teams. So definitely think that this will be a good game tonight, because I think that Crystal Palace might be quietly confident, but so will Brighton, considering how they've started.
Are we getting a bit carried away with Brighton's start, though, when you look at the teams they've actually played? Probably, I mean, they lost to Everton, they beat Watford, they beat Burnley, they beat Leicester City, who have been poor so far this season. They beat Brentford, who have been a bit of a surprise package, but they're yet to face any of kind of the big six.
Yeah, and they're next.
And they still haven't.
Yeah, well, they're next... Four games, obviously, they've got Crystal Palace tonight, which is a rivalry. Mm. And then they've got a home game against Arsenal, who obviously have just beaten Tottenham quite convincingly. Then they go to Norwich. Now, they should win that. And then it's Manchester City at home at the end of October. They've got Leicester in the League Cup, and then Liverpool, Newcastle, Villa, Leeds, West Ham. So actually, the fixtures are quite favourable for them, in terms of they are playing a couple of big teams in the next month or so, but not really back-to-back.
Yeah.
It's kind of, they'll have Norwich, then City, and then they'll have someone else who you think that they'll quite fancy a result against. So you're right, in terms of them not facing really anyone of real significance and stature just yet. But they're doing well in the games that they are playing. And if they can pick up points in games, you know, the kind of run-of-the-mill general Premier League games that aren't against the bigger hitters, and establish themselves a big gap between the relegation zone and where they are, that's a huge benefit to them and a huge bonus to them, considering where they have been floating around just above the drop for the last three or four seasons.
They're going to be missing Bissouma tonight, who has been, or could be missing Bissouma, who's got a knee injury, so there's a late fitness test. He's been one of the massive positives for Brighton this season, Marley. And they've got some decent players. I mean, they've got people like Danny Welbeck and Adam Lallana, who have showed flashes of brilliance during their careers, but maybe don't deliver on a
particularly regular basis. Sean Duffy's been playing well this season, although he was out, he wasn't even in the picture. He was out
on loan.
The start
of your sentence was they've got decent players, and then you go in with Welbeck and Lallana.
But they've been all right so far this season. That's the thing, isn't it? It's kind of they're players who have potential, and occasionally they show it. But Bissouma has been outstanding in that midfield.
Yeah, he has. He's probably the key to how they play. Like the pressing, the possession. He's got all of that. He's very energetic. He doesn't give anyone a minute in the midfield. He doesn't allow them to play their game. He's always on them. And he's comfortable in possession as well. He's got enough to suggest he can play at a top six side, I would say.
Mm. He's linked with Liverpool over the weekend.
Yeah, he was. He linked in the summer as well, I think. But you know, it didn't happen. I think it's one of them where it didn't happen in the summer, but if he has a good season, I think it happens at the end of the season, definitely. Especially if Brighton don't finish in the top half or, you know, anywhere significant. So he's top player. It'd be a big miss for them tonight because I'm not sure who would come into that midfield and do a similar job. I think they lose a lot in midfield, especially, you know, the likes of Conor Gallagher at Crystal Palace is one that needs to be shackled. He's probably the one midfielder you'd look at and say, okay, we have to keep an eye on him because he can get forward and chip in with a goal or two. So Brighton will be hoping Bissouma can come through because he's very, very important to how they play.
Let's talk about Palace because we've spoken at length about Brighton. I mean, for them, they've got Edouard, the guy from Celtic, came in the transfer window. I wrote him off instantly, said he couldn't do it in the Premier League.
Scored inside 30 seconds.
Scored two goals in his debut. Not started a game yet, not started a home game for Crystal Palace. Surely he's not that far away from displacing Christian Benteke as the man to lead the attack from the off, though, is he?
Not tonight, I wouldn't think. You know, with it being a big blood and thunder derby. you don't want to. It's just not one you'd chuck him in on his first start because if he doesn't adapt to it straight away, then you've made a bit of a mistake. But I think Benteke will start, probably do Nout for 70 minutes, and then Edouard will come on for the last 20 or 25 and be the sort of guy who can maybe take advantage of a few tired legs or whatever. But he's not far off. Starting over Benteke, I'd probably say next week, whoever they've got next, he'll probably start that game instead.
A Palace getting dangerously close to being not a one-man team, Niall, when you look at the players they've got. They've still got Wolf-Sahar, but now they've got Eze, who's injured at the moment. They've got Edouard, who looks impressive. They've got Gallagher on loan as well from Chelsea that we've already talked about. Quietly, they're kind of there's more about them than just Wilfred Zaha now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But also, I think that they're still massively inconsistent. And I think they have been for the last however many years under Roy Hodgson. But in their inconsistency, they've been consistent enough to stay in the Premier League and be mid-table. And that's what Roy Hodgson gave them, wasn't it? It was, you know, they might win a couple, then lose a couple, then draw a couple. You know, so you could call that consistent in their inconsistency in terms of not winning games back to back to back to back. But you wouldn't expect that from Crystal Palace anyway. So I think that actually Roy Hodgson deserves credit for the foundations he's laid. And it's actually given Crystal Palace the opportunity to hand a first managerial stint to someone like Patrick Vieira, who will have his own ideas that will be different to Roy Hodgson's. And he'll be looking to implement them. And to try and do that in the first six games of a season is difficult. But we've seen what Palace can do in the way they beat Tottenham. They were dominant even before the Tanganga sending off in that game. Crystal Palace were the better side. And I think it, particularly at Selhurst Park, is something they're going to need to capitalise on. Because I think at home, they can be a little bit more expressive. Certainly the fans will want to see that. You know, a lot of teams like playing two defensive midfielders now in that 4-2-3-1 formation. And I think a lot of the criticism is at home. Do you need to play two defensive midfielders when the fans are on side? They want to see that aggressive football. I think every club's fans wants to see that. And so, yeah, Crystal Palace, in terms of a one-man team, Wilfred Zaha is still very important to what they do and how they do it. But Edouard got off to a perfect start, you know, with the two goals on his debut. And it's certainly a project that you can see at Crystal Palace from the outside looking in. So they've brought in Edouard. Does that mean Benteke is in his final year? We say this every season because he's terrible and then his contract is up for negotiation.
He scores eight in the last three games.
Eight in the last however many games. Yeah, absolutely. So that's certainly something. And with the flavour of players that they've brought in, Eberle Eze is obviously a young player, injured at the moment. Nathan Ferguson, they signed from West Brom 2 seasons ago, hasn't played because he's been injured. Michael Elise, I watched him for Palace's under-23s last week, last Monday, in fact, and he was unbelievably good. They beat Leicester under-23s, I think 6-1, and he assisted or was involved in 5 of the goals. And he was another, I think, they brought in from Reading, who looks really promising, 19 years of age, also French like Patrick Vieira. So they've got that blend now of youth and experience. You know, the likes of Gary Cahill, they've said goodbye to, but they've also got players who have been in the Premier League for a number of years, like Milivojevic, who probably isn't the greatest in terms of quality, but he does have experience in terms of playing in the Premier League. So maybe that's something that they're looking to try and do, is stand themselves in good stead for the future with some of these players like Eberle Eze and Edouard, who are just kind of still getting to grips with the Premier League, but might be real assets for them in the next few years.
Are you sold on Vieira yet? I think we all wrote off Vieira when he was appointed at Crystal Palace. I think a fair few of us, myself included, might have said, that's it, they're down, that's it, relegation. But he's done all right so far. It's difficult to criticise what he's done at Palace to date.
Yeah, I suppose so. And it's easy to forget that it's his first managerial job, even though he's been at New York City and Manchester City. Obviously, he was a manager of New York City in America, but in terms of a European club, it's his first job, particularly to take on a Premier League club, is a big step. They've got
he
a game
in Nice for a bit, wasn't he?
Of course he was, yeah. Sorry, yeah. My apologies. Yeah, no, he was. And actually, if you look at them, 15th in the table going into tonight's game, 5 games played, and below them in the table, look at the teams who are below them. Southampton, who haven't won but have drawn a number of games. Newcastle, Leeds, Burnley and Norwich. So really, you know, are they in and around where you'd expect them to be? Because all of the teams below them haven't been that good this season at all. You know, 2 or 3 of them still looking for their first wins of the campaign. So I think that that says a lot, and I think it's probably too early to tell. I can see what he's trying to do. But I think, again, it's always the old cliche. The barometer is around the end of November, start of December, heading into Christmas. If things are still looking like, you know, they're around 12th to 15th, I think that Palace fans will be okay with that.
Could be up to 12th if they do win tonight. And as I said earlier, Brighton could be topping the Premier League by the end of the game. Tonight is Brighton versus Palace, kickoff at 8 o'clock. We're going to do our heroes and villains next, wrapping up the weekend with our saints and sinners from the last couple of days. This is Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. Don't forget, you can find your next favourite sport podcast on the Sports Social Podcast Network, including Football Social Daily, a load of others as well. If you head to sport-social.co.uk, you can find everything there, including all the latest news on your team, whoever it is you support in the top flight of English football. And we're going to talk about the heroes and villains from the top flight of English football now. We'll start with heroes today. We'll start with the positives, as always. Who are you going to give your hero status to, Niall?
Oh, well, it was hard for me to pick any of the 11 players who turned out for Brentford at the weekend against Liverpool at the Brentford Community Stadium. And on the other side, I thought Mo Salah was very good, scored again. I think it was his 100th Liverpool goal in the Premier League. He already reached 100 Premier League goals a couple of weeks ago. Of course, he bagged a couple of Chelsea in the short time he was there. And he reached 100 Premier League goals faster than Thierry Henry. And I think that he's still somewhat understated for the impact he's had for Liverpool and for how good a player he really is. Lots of talk about Liverpool's greatest ever 11, and I've seen so many people that haven't picked Mohamed Salah, but have put Suarez in there. Suarez is brilliant, but Salah is better, and has been better for Liverpool. And I don't think there's a question there. The stats are there, the silverware is there to prove it, Champions League and Premier League, and he's still going. So for me, I think Salah is a notable second to any of the 11 Brentford players, as I say. Brilliant game. I was driving back from a game myself at the weekend and only managed to catch most of it on the radio and then watched the highlights later on that night. And it was a brilliant game. Really fun, really entertaining. I was delighted for Brentford because I said at the start of the season, I think they'll surprise a few. A lot of people had them in the bottom three. I don't think they will go down. If they carry on the rate that they're going with the work rate and the players that they've got and the desire they've got, I think that they can really upset a few more teams this season. And Jurgen Klopp isn't normally smiling after a draw at the end of a game, but in his post-match interview, he was smiling and saying, do you know what? Fair play to Brentford. They deserve it. And for someone as whiny and whingy as Jurgen Klopp to come out and say that post-match, I think that's notable, the amount of credit that Brentford do deserve. Thought they played really, really well. Balls into the box were causing some real problems for Liverpool, and they just had a great game. And, you know, that's another evening for them to remember at the Brentford Community Stadium, a new home for them. They beat Arsenal on the first day of the season, their first time back in the top flight for, I think, 70-odd years. And now they've got a draw against Liverpool to talk about. Very nearly a victory as well. I think they could have easily won the game with some of the chances they had. I think for me, Brentford are my heroes for the weekend. And just a quick one on Brentford and why they'll survive for me this season, and the reason Norwich City won't, despite the fact Norwich have got players who are experienced in the Premier League, is Norwich, their players have got scars. Their players have got scars from the last time they're in the Premier League.
Mm.
Brentford don't have that. They've come into the top flight with players who are willing and hungry to prove themselves at the level, players who have almost had it drummed into them because of the nature of Moneyball and the way that they've been signed by Brentford, that they were undervalued. You know, we've signed you for 2 million, but actually the statistics suggest you could be one of the best players in the division if you keep your head down and knuckle down. And I think that injection of confidence and that injection of belief from the powers that be at Brentford, including the manager, of course, I think that is conducive to excellent and 100% committed performances. So
Ivan Toney is some player as well. I mean, he didn't score against Liverpool, but he was a constant thorn in their side.
This is a guy who was in League One 2 years ago, playing for Peterborough. You know, Marley will know a little bit about him because he was at Newcastle before, but he never really showed it, I don't think, when he was up on Tyneside. But since he kind of dropped out of the elite level and it came down to the lower leagues, he's proven again exactly what sort of a player he can be. And just look at the way the Brentford model works. You know, Ben Rama's gone to West Ham.
Mm.
Ollie Watkins has gone to Aston Villa. Both of those players sold for £30 million. Now they've got Ivan Toney, who could be worth £30 million if he produces a 15-goal Premier League season this year, you know, and Brentford stay up, and someone's sniffing around looking for a striker. You know, there's no reason why he can't be sold. And then once he goes, they'll find the next one. So it's a brilliant method, a brilliant model, and it's great to see them succeeding in the Premier League at the moment. I think it will be a bit closer come the end of the season in terms of relegation, but I just think that they've got these players that have belief and desire and a willingness to prove that they are capable and they are good enough to be at the level, whereas Norwich have got too many players who are scarred, battle-scarred, and have that mental fatigue from the last time they're in the Premier League, and I think that counts for a lot. So Brentford are my heroes, all 11 of them.
Liverpool love a little bit of net spend chat. I'd love to see Brentford's net spend. I wonder what that is. Marley, who's your hero from the weekend?
I'm struggling to pick between two, and that's Saka and Smith Rowe at Arsenal. I thought both of them were quality in that the win over Spurs. I thought they, as locally produced lads, there's nothing like having a locally produced player who comes through. You know, Smith Rowe's they call him the Hale End De Bruyne and stuff like that. And, I mean, that's probably a bit too far, a bit of a stretch, but It brings it home that local players coming through and playing for your team and producing things in the biggest games. And the biggest game for Arsenal is still always Spurs. So I think his performance at the weekend was fantastic. Saka backed him up superbly. He had Reguilon on toast for most of the game. Got an assist, got a goal, nearly got another assist in the second half as well. And it was just a constant thorn. And I'm pleased for Saka after coming off the difficult summer he had, obviously, you know, with what happened with his missed penalty and all the rest of it. It's nice to see him turn in that first sort of game-changing, almost man-of-the-match performance in, like I say, the biggest game. So the pair of them were just brilliant. I didn't think Spurs did that much wrong in the first half, just Arsenal were way better. The reason I say that is, like, Spurs were trying to press Arsenal, and that's what you got to do. You got to make it hard for them to play and suffocate them. But Arsenal were too good in possession, and they've not been good in possession this summer. This season. But Smith Rowe in particular, and Partey and Saka were, you know, one of those new phrases in football where they were press resistant. They passed through the press and made them look daft.
I've never heard that phrase before. Is that a new, is that like the next, is that this season's double pivot?
Trust me, okay. in the next year. Now I've said it, now you'll notice it everywhere. Press resistant, that is the new thing of football Twitter. Friggin'
loves it. Sounds like what you want in trousers, isn't it? Give us some press resistant trousers.
Yeah, like a Corby trouser press or something. but he's, you know, they were passing it through the lines, and as soon as you get pressure on you, if you can pass it past that person and run away from them, you know, that's you're in there. And Arsenal did that a few times in the game, in the first half especially. And Smith Rowe and Saka were central to that.
Yeah.
You know, both got a goal and an assist. So the pair of them are my heroes for definite.
I'm going to make a hero nomination that I don't think anyone can disagree with. Raul Jimenez, who scored his first goal for the club after his injury, 336 days or something ridiculous like
that. It was all about the assist, wasn't it, from Jose Sa?
Well, doesn't that really matter? That's not really the point, is it? That's not really the issue here. I think the fact that he is back playing, that takes a huge amount of mental strength when you've been through a horrific injury like he has. And the fact that he is back and he's scoring goals deserves a huge amount of credit, not just to him, but to the medical team that got him back as well. So, and Wolves, to be fair, have struggled without him,
yeah.
I think. So it's good to see him back scoring goals. But let's get on to the really fun bit. Let's do the villains from the weekend. Can I go first with the villains?
You can.
It comes off the back of what you're talking about, Marley, because I'm nominating Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang as the villain of the weekend.
Why?
Because of his celebration that he did. The copying Thierry Henry on the knee slide. It's like...
I thought you were going to be like a grass lover and, you know, hit the huge marks that they leave every time they
He's
slide.
Doing his groundsman's course.
I do feel like this. It's a little bit gammony, this complaint, but I think the fact you're emulating...
Hey, if the cap fits.
If you're emulating your team's, one of your team's greatest ever players, you've kind of got to earn the right to do that. And I think the way Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has played over the last... Well, since he signed his new contract, he's not lived up to that status. So I don't think he should do it. And okay. I think that kind of has summed up the issues with Arsenal over the past couple of years.
You didn't say much about Lingard doing the Ronaldo thing the other week.
I didn't see that.
Oh, it's because you love Lingard too much.
Well, do you know what? He can do one as well in that case. But it's like, you've got to earn it. If you're going to do that, you've got to earn it. And I don't think Aubameyang is in a place where he's earned it yet. It would be like Joe Linton doing the Alan Shearer celebration after scoring his Newcastle.
He's got a score first.
Exactly. So there we go. That's mine. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He's my villain of the weekend. Who are you going for, Noel?
God, you can't enjoy anything these days, can you?
No, do you know what? I literally
bloody strikers scoring goals.
My villain is Bruno Fernandes. And not for the skied penalty.
Is that because his penalty broke your window at home?
Yeah, well, it could have done, to be fair. It's in that general direction. It wasn't because of the penalty miss, nor for the fact that he crumbled under the pressure of Cristiano Ronaldo glaring at him from behind. And
was there a bit of a debate? I didn't see the game. So
no,
was there
no. Bruno picked the ball up.
Well, he's the penalty taker. That's fair enough.
He's the penalty taker, and there's
not anymore.
You can't deny there must be a small part of Ronaldo that's thinking, "Get in there. I'm going to take the next penalty."
100%.
Bruno Fernandes is the villain for me, not for the missed penalty, because it's just his second missed penalty in I think 20 odd attempts for Manchester United. He's only missed four in his career, and he scored I think 42-43 overall. The last one he missed was against Newcastle, and I think he went and scored in that game anyway and kind of made amends. And the second was this one over the top. He didn't do his run, skip, hop, which I'm not always the biggest fan of anyway. It wasn't about the miss for me. Misses happen in football. Mm. Players miss penalties. Mark Noble missed one last week. He got some stick. Bruno Fernandes is going to get some stick. And the next one will inevitably be taken by Cristiano Ronaldo. The reason he's my villain is because he felt the need to go onto social media and post what was quite a lengthy, wordy statement of apology to the Manchester United fans for missing the penalty. Now, for me, that puts him in the villain category because he has no need to do that. I don't understand this idea that sports people have to apologise when they make a mistake, because it's part of sport that you're going to lose games. It's part of sport. You're going to have a bad game. You're going to miss a penalty. You're going to get sent off. Now, it's a game against Aston Villa in the Premier League at Old Trafford. Last minute, blazes it over. I completely understand why Bruno Fernandes would feel the need to apologise, but he doesn't have to apologise. And he's gone onto Twitter, and it's like two paragraphs, two photos, screenshot that he's put on there. I don't understand this.
Is it part of the result of the... Because I think Manchester United has a bit of a poisonous atmosphere around it at the moment in terms of the fan base. There seems to be this swing on a results-by-results basis.
It's just the nature of the size of the club that every time they lose, it feels that way. Mm. Because when they beat Newcastle
and
Ronaldo was back, it felt like the best Manchester United atmosphere there's been for however long. At least since I've lived in Manchester, it's never felt like that before. And after two defeats, or three defeats now in the space of 10 days, that atmosphere might have switched, which is understandable. And then you've got Bruno Fernandes, who misses this penalty and feels the need to apologise. Why are you apologising?
It's part of the game, mate.
It's part of the game, Bruno. So it's not the miss that he's a villain for. And I understand why he's done it and posted an apology. And maybe that's something that a social media manager has said, or maybe you should apologise. Or maybe he felt that he wanted to do that. And if that's the case, that's totally fine. I just don't think he needed to. Mm. Bruno Fernandes doesn't have to apologise to anyone. Since he came into Manchester United, he has transformed that team. And I don't think anyone can disagree with that, no matter what persuasion you are, whether you're a City fan, a Liverpool fan, any other fan. Bruno Fernandes has been magnificent for Manchester United in the main since he came into the club. He's going to make mistakes. Every person does, let alone sports person. So for me, he's a villain for that, not for the missed penalty, but for the fact that he felt that he needed to, you know, spend some time constructing a message and apologising when actually, Bruno, you don't need to. You've done more than enough for the club.
I've got a feeling Bruno Fernandes does not even know his Twitter password, to be honest with you. I think it would be surprising if he had anything to do with that statement. Marley, wrap us up. Who is your villain from the weekend?
My villain, obviously, you already know it's going to be Newcastle based, don't you? Because we didn't win at the weekend.
Yeah, we could just clip your comments from every previous podcast and
just repeat what he said.
Insert new name. It's not Bruce. It could be, obviously, but I'm probably going to go for Bruce next week. So this week it's Jacob Murphy. We had seven chances to kill off Watford at any stage of that game. You know, Joe Linton didn't miss a chance, I can remember, actually. But
Saint-Maximin,
you were?
It's a fair assumption.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Saint-Maximin had chances, Longstaff had chances to go 2-0 up. But the biggest one was Murphy, literally 30 seconds from the end of the game. He gets put through by Saint-Maximin. He's one-on-one with Ben Foster. And instead of just either trying to go around the goalie or slotting it past him and getting a shot away, he decides to try and chip Ben Foster. And it's not on, it's too straight. It's got to be really good contact at a really high speed to get that right. And for a midfielder who doesn't score a massive amount of goals, that's a really tough finish. So you've got to understand the situation there and just get a shot away. If he saves it, fine. You know, you can say, flipping hell, it's a really good save in a really big moment of the game. But it was poor. It was a bad decision, and we didn't win the game because of it. We should have won it before that, but it's like a clutch moment. You have to come up big in them moments, and you have to do that. And he didn't. He ballsed it. So the one thing I do want to say is my feelings can't be summed up any better than John Anderson on BBC Radio Newcastle, who was doing the commentary for the game. And I've got the commentary here, so I want to play it. So this is what John Anderson's reaction was. So obviously you can't see the clip on the podcast, but this is when Murphy goes through. So.
Oh, lovely neutral commentary.
Isn't that brilliant though? That just put it in the net. Yeah. Absolutely. I peed my pants when I listened. I couldn't find a stream for the game, so I was watching it on Final Score, and I seen it as soon as that come out, went on Twitter, found it, and I thought that just sums up absolutely everything, because as soon as you see that clip, that is what you're thinking in your head. And John Anderson, just no relation to me, by the way, I wish he was, but yeah, what a guy. He's completely summed it up there. Jacob, just put it in the net, man.
Are you worried yet, Marley, when you look at the teams that you fail to get results against, and you're like the teams you're not beating are the teams around you, Watford, Leeds, Southampton, with Burnley in the cup, wasn't it? But you still failed to get a result at Burnley. These are the teams that surely Newcastle need to be picking up points against.
Yeah, it is. And I think the one thing we're missing, I mean, if Callum Wilson's playing that game, we win that 4-1 easy. But we're struggling to finish without him, so we need him. We need his little, you know, hamstrings made of sawdust to get better. And so we need him for 10, 12 games in a row, because we haven't had that since he signed for us. And he still gets one in two every time he plays properly. So hopefully he can come back and start sort of inspiring us. If he was in the team and we were still not winning games, I'd be really, really worried. But he's not been in the team for the last three games, I don't think. So I feel like that's where we can easily improve and start getting some goals, because our general level of play isn't that bad at the minute. We should have beat Watford at the weekend. We should have won last week as well, but didn't, because we didn't have enough up front.
We look forward to your criticism of Newcastle next Monday when we do Heroes and Villains again.
Same time, same place.
Same time, same place. That is it for Football Social Daily today. We'll be back again tomorrow with another podcast looking back at that Brighton versus Crystal Palace game and potentially hailing Graham Potter as the greatest football manager of all time. I've got to say, I think he looks the part this season. New beard,
Paul
new
Weller
threads.
Inspired, yeah.
Yeah, he's looking good as Graham Potter, so fair play. Deserves some credit for that, if nothing else. That is it for Football Social Daily. We'll see you next time.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.